He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Duncan Smith.
Today we find out how agritourism and market gardening work together on a Southland farm.
Leah heads up the longest no-exit road in the country to find mushrooms in a woolshed.
And later I'm among drones, driverless tractors, nude sheep and comfy rocking chairs at the Central District's field days.
But first to our roundup of the week's agricultural news with RNZ's rural reporter Sally Murphy. And Sally, some figures are coming through from the ag sector on the likely losses from Cyclone Gabrielle.
Kia ora, Duncan. That's right. The state-owned farming company Pāmu has dropped its forecast profit for the year from $55 million down to between $34 and $44 million after 24 of its farms suffered cyclone damage. I asked Pāmu's chief executive, Mark Leslie, just how big the bill's likely to be.
Our current estimates, and this is early preliminary one probably to clarify, is around $6.5 million of investment in this current financial year and into next year. A small part of that is operational costs. A big part of it is capital associated with fences, roadways, bridges, infrastructure related. So we will continue to review that and make sure we're making the right decisions that set those farms up to be successful going forward.
Weakening commodity prices are also to blame. Pāmu says the falling dairy price and lower schedules for lamb will also dent its profits.
And Sally, combined with growing input costs, it does sound like a perfect storm. You've been speaking to beekeepers too, and they've also been counting their losses.
Yeah, this is a crazy number, but we've heard that thousands of hives were either washed away completely or have been left severely damaged by the storm. I put in a call to Apiculture New Zealand's chief executive, Karen Koss, who says they're still working on the numbers, but the destruction in Hawke's Bay and Tairāwhiti is significant.
Our sort of early estimates at this stage are we think about 5,000 to 6,000 hives have been lost and or damaged by the flooding, but there's probably at least the same amount, if not more, hives cut off from road access, so people can't actually get to them. So it's severe for us, for the beekeepers.
Added to that, there's a bit of an issue with disease prevention now. That's something normally done before winter, but it's a challenge for beekeepers to get to their hives to check on them.
So can any of the hives be salvaged?
Well, we spoke to the president of the Hawke's Bay Bee Club, Graham Heaven. He says hundreds of hives have washed up on a beach near Awatoto in Napier, but because there's so much debris, it's just not safe to try and pick them up. He lost 100 of his 120 hives, and he says there's going to be a massive shortage of bees for the pollination of crops in the spring.
We do a lot of pollination work early spring for the kiwi fruit and apples, and of course there could be a bit of shortage of hives next year unless they bring them in from other areas, like, you know, from Wairarapa or Manawatū, something like that. They'll be bringing hives in this year for pollination, I'd say, because a lot of the smaller beekeepers, you know, with 100 hives or 200 hives, they actually had to rely on pollination work in the orchards, you know, to make it work for them.
Yes, well, the storm certainly had a sting in its tail, but let's change tack and focus on some good news now. Sally, I hear farmers in Southland finally got some decent rain this week.
They did. Someone must have done a bit of a rain dance because the skies opened after months without any significant rainfall. Ben Dooley farms sheep and beef near Gore. He got about 60 millimetres on Monday afternoon, and then there was more on Tuesday and Wednesday.
That's enough. Yep, that's enough. I mean, we need more rain, but the fear now is that it gets cold and keeps raining. We still need some heat. So, yeah, no, that's a good soaking. That's... Yeah, there's going to be plenty of moisture in the soil now to keep us going for a wee while.
Further north at Hamish Belsky's sheep and beef farm between Balclutha and Clinton, about 30 millimetres of rain fell. It had been incredibly dry there, but Hamish says that's enough to turn things green, which is a big morale boost.
Great news. Now, struggling rural health services, they're always a hot topic. What's the latest there?
We chatted to a health professor and rural hospital doctor, Gary Nixon, who's spoken out about the need to address the comms breakdown during Cyclone Gabrielle. Take a listen to what he had to say about the challenge it presented for rural healthcare providers.
So during the worst of it, so I understand that there was real problems with those small local health services communicating with the base hospitals, where they get advice and send their very unwell patients but also communicating with different parts of that same health service and communicating with their patients. So I reached the point that doctors and nurses in some of those small health services and hospitals had to basically sleep at the health service just because they knew that's their local patients would know to come there, even if they couldn't communicate with them in any other way.
Te Whatu Ora, Health New Zealand, says it'll work with other agencies to review the health response to Cyclone Gabrielle.
Yeah, and look, I was a bit surprised to hear about this next bit of news because it doesn't seem that long ago when demand was outstripping supply for timber products across the country. But there's a dent in demand for building timber at the moment. You would have thought cyclone damage would be keeping mills busy.
You would think that, wouldn't you? But AgriHQ forestry analyst Rhys Brick says the number of red-stickered houses is only about a week's worth of work for current sawmill capacity. He told us construction and DIY projects have really slowed down due to those higher interest rates and weaker house prices.
General commentary around it is relatively negative, at least when it comes to structural timber. There's just been a massive slowdown in demand for that in the past sort of 3-4 months. And, mills are sort of having to adjust their operations to work around that with the lower cost of selling on the spot market, plus, just trying to reduce supply out of their own mills so they're not swamping the market, essentially.
Rhys says the log export market is perkier with generally good prices and improved demand coming out of China.
And it looks like demand for the New Zealand deer hunting experience is high, Sally. We're heading into one of those most important events on the deer hunting calendar, aren't we? It's the Roar coming up.
Yeah, plenty of people excited about that. And most guides are fully booked after essentially no international punters over the past few years due to COVID border closures. Simon Guild is the president of the Professional Hunting Guides Association and runs tours in Canterbury. His books are full right through until 2025.
Most guides that I know and have talked to are absolutely bursting at the seams, which is a good problem to have compared to the last 3 years when we've been really scrambling for business survival.
Simon Guild says it should be a great season because there are more animals around after a couple of years of fewer hunters stalking them.
Great. Thanks very much, Sally. Good luck to anyone heading into the bush this season.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Te Taranaki now, where Leah's met a farmer turned builder turned mushroom grower. Kyle Davies found himself addicted to growing gourmet mushrooms and in 10 months has built a serious horticultural enterprise. So after Kyle had been around the coast at 2 a.m. delivering his fresh fungi, Leah travelled up Waitotara Valley Road to see how it all happens.
We call it Paradise Valley. We're about 34 k's up, hidden away in the hills.
Where does the road lead to?
Nowhere.
Is it really? Yeah, nowhere.
What is it? It's the longest dead-end road in the
Southern Hemisphere.
Or second longest. Yeah.
What made you guys decide to move all the way up here? You originally had a bit of farmland.
I'm from the area and then went to Aussie. We met in Australia. I went for a cruise around the world and I didn't get out of Melbourne.
I went to work there. I'm a theatre nurse.
Oh.
And I was recruited by the Australian government to work in Melbourne. And then I met Kyle over there and then he wanted to come back here, so I came back here with him.
So. Did you get turned off when you were driving up and thinking, where the heck is this place?
Nah.
Yeah, Kat's nodding her head.
Yes, I did. Oh, no,
there was the middle of nowhere.
And when you moved here, you were farming?
Yep.
And building at the same time?
Yep.
What was that like?
Busy?
Oh, yeah. No, it was all right. My sister used to come and help muster and everything. Yeah, and we'd have shearing weekends and everyone would turn up. We'd put on the beer and the food and there'd be shearing done in a couple of days.
So any time you had a building job to do, you were travelling that at least half an hour drive down the road to get there?
Yeah, it's actually contracting to a company and doing houses away. Building in Owakuni and places like that.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'd leave Monday morning and come home Friday night. Yeah.
And then it wasn't until a few years ago, right, that you took a bit of a break from it?
And yeah, what, 2 years ago, yeah. I decided to have a winter off and got bored. So I thought, I've got to find something to do while I'm at home. And hunted around, and I've always been interested in button mushrooms, but that's a mega setup to do that. So, and I actually seen some of these on the internet from a fella Oakenspore down in Christchurch. So I rang him up and ordered some bat ready to grow bags, and yeah, got addicted from there. Yeah, just enjoyed it. So.
At this time, Carl had sold off most of the farm. However, he kept 12 hectares, including the olive green wool shed, originally an aircraft hangar in Whanganui, brought to the farm by the previous owner and reassembled. And now that structure is having its third lease on life. Instead of pens full of sheep, there were shelves packed with bags of pine pellets inoculated with mushroom spores.
I'd still spend my days over here with a cold beer and tinkering away in the shed. And yeah, I just grew a couple to start with. And then I just, yeah, from there I thought, well, maybe I'll grow some, try taking them to the market, see what happens. These are the beginning.
The pellets.
Yeah, bags of soybean hull and pine pellets. I made up a little machine so that I can bag them up, add the water, and then they go into the steam box and steam to sterilise them and kill off the bugs in there for 20, 30 hours. Let them cool down, and then from there they go up into the lab where we inoculate them with the grain spawn.
This machine here is soy one side, pine the other, and then a shoot down the bottom middle.
Yeah, just with a slide drawer in it.
And it just mixes it all up and pops it into the bag.
That's what they grow in. Gives them the nutrients and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, let's go to the next part of the process. The spore room, is that what it's called?
Yeah, up in the little, I've got a little lab up there with a HEPA filter and that in it.
So just walking it down to a whole nother part of the once wool shed.
So yeah, the HEPA filter will do all our work in front of that.
This filter?
Yeah.
What's the benefit of it?
99.9% of everything is taken out through the filter, so it's all clean air coming out the front of it, blowing out into your work, so you can't get any contamination in that in there. Yeah.
What is the bits of contamination you're worried about?
The green mould, like on your bread, that's the worst one.
How does that appear? Is that just because of that wet process?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to keep that out in a process that we're doing.
Mm.
So that's why we steam everything to knock it back. The steaming doesn't actually sterilise it, but it knocks everything back far enough that the mycelium will take off, you know, quick and grow before anything else can grow. Sometimes I have the odd mishap and you get green bags that you've got to throw out. It all starts with the grain spawn, with the mushroom spawn. That's what the white mycelium and everything growing in there. I mean, they start out like that after they come out the steriliser.
Right, yeah, they just look like grain of some sort.
Yeah, so they come out of there with a little bit of grain spawn in them. I just made these this morning.
Oh, yeah, they kind of look much the same, but just a bit finer.
See, yeah, you can see little bits through it. So there was only like three of those spoonfuls into that whole bag. Just mix it through it.
And they sit here for how long?
They'll take about 2 weeks, and then they'll be ready to fruit. So all we do there is put some holes in it, and fold that down, and then into the humidity room, and mushrooms will grow.
Just like that.
Just like that.
So this is the next room we're off to?
Into the fruiting chamber.
Whoa. I kind of feel like I've moved into a different universe. There's all these creatures sort of poking out of the bags.
Yeah, humidity's around 84, 86 at the moment, percent, yeah.
Yeah, you've got shelves on top of shelves filled with those bags that we've been looking at, but now you've got creatures, mushrooms coming out of them.
Yeah, so that's your pink, nice and bright, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so vibrant, it's almost, it's corally colour, like you were saying before.
This one here is your corals too.
Oh, well, they do look like coral, or a little bit like a cauliflower even.
Yeah, when they're growing big, they'll hang down like about that big.
Wow, that's two hands.
Yeah, like two handfuls.
And they sort of grow in like big layers, not just like one mushroom.
Yeah, no, it'll the pins will start and then it just keeps spreading and spreading into a big bunch, considering it only comes out of a hole that's, you know, like an inch.
So what's the full menu?
We grow grey and pink oyster mushrooms, the shiitake, and we're just starting to get into coral's tooth, or peki peki kiori. They also call it New Zealand lion's mane, but it's a native mushroom. A lot of people reckon it tastes sort of seafoody. I've eaten a lot of seafood, but yeah, so I don't know. Everyone gets a different flavour out of them. The pink one they call bacon mushroom, so if you fry it crispy, it tastes got that bacony flavour. And we also do the grow bags, so people can buy the bag, take it home and grow it themselves. People just like to grow nice, fresh food, and I mean, they can grow them on their kitchen bench, right beside the fry pan, really, as soon as they're ready.
Kyle Davey there of Valley Mushrooms, and you also heard a snippet from Kath Davey. And in case you're looking for new mushroom recipes, the pair fall head over heels for some mushroom pâté.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Anyway, last week Cosmo was at the Garston Hop Farm in northern Southland. Not far from there, some more farm diversification's been happening. Rather than hops, though, it's more like off-the-beaten-track adventure. Welcome Rock Trails is based at Blackmore Station. And to find out more, Cosmo's with Tom O'Brien.
Oh, there are some noisy animals down there.
Yep, that's right. Yep, some Angus cattle.
Are they your neighbours?
No, they're... Those cows are Morris's, the lessees. So we're at a spot called the Dog Graveyard, 10 minutes above the farm homesteads. This is where I bury the farm dogs that die. I just bury them up on this little high point here as a sign of respect. So, yeah, it's a great view from here, good vantage point.
Mm. What's happening down in those big paddocks on the flat?
So the guys are harvesting oats flat out at the moment. So, yeah, there's barley, oats and wheat. So they're pretty much taking advantage of the drier conditions that we've got here at the moment. So, they'll go flat out and keep going until they're finished. So they'll probably go into the night.
It looks like they've got a good crop there.
They have, yeah. No, the crops yield very, very well up here. We've got silt clay loamy type soils. They're quite heavy soils, and doesn't matter what's been grown on there, whether it's grass or oats or, as you know, sort of just down the road, our neighbours growing hops. So we're very, very lucky to have the soils we've got.
And you were brought up on this farm, weren't you?
Yeah, yep. So we started farming here in 1911. So my great-grandparents and then my grandparents and then my parents and then us. And, yeah, it's home for me and I'm biased, but, yeah, no, it's a pretty beautiful spot, really.
Do you still farm this land?
So, no, I actually ended up stopping farming in the traditional sense in around 2010. And so I sold all my Angus cattle and my Perrindales. And I ended up going into sort of the more agri-tourism side of things.
Do you take people on tours? What sort of agri-tourism are you talking about?
So I had a chance meeting with someone in Kingston, just sort of 15 kilometres up the road there. He was a cartographer, a mapping specialist, and he'd been mapping whale feeding grounds down in the southern sub-Antarctics. So I questioned him a bit more, and he said, oh, when he's not doing that, he maps mountain bike trails all around the world. And so I thought that was pretty interesting as well. So we just started yarning about stuff, and then he said, oh, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm farming just down the road, and it's a hill country place. And he said, oh, could I come down and have a look? And I said, oh, for sure. So Gary came down and he had a look, and we went up to the tops and over the back, and he saw the water race, the gold mining water race that the gold miners had built 130 years ago, and he saw the restored mud brick Chinese gold miner's hut that we restored. And
here on the farm?
Yep. And he said to me, oh, this is a pretty special place. And he said, would you ever consider maybe building a trail, a mountain bike trail up here? And I said, oh, I don't know, I hadn't really thought about it. So that seed was sown, and he gave me a couple of textbooks, and I bought a clinometer to measure gradient, and he was kind of my anchor man for the project, and I went out and started building. Yeah.
You started building a mountain bike trail by hand?
By hand, yep. No machinery, no. So I went to E. Hayes and Sons in Invercargill, and I got myself some 5-pound picks. They needed to be 5 pounds. They needed to have a bit of weight in them, because what the soil that I was digging into, well, it was predominantly made up of snow tussock, large tussocks, acephalia, Spaniard grass, rock. So, yeah, I bought some wheelbarrows and rakes and picks, and on the 8th of June 2012 I started digging on the southern boundary, and I think I was digging for about 2 hours, and I remember looking out and going, oh hell, I've only done about, you know, 20 metres, you know, and so I sort of sat down and I put my head in my hands and kind of went, what the hell am I doing? Exactly. But I looked out at the view and I thought about those gold miners, and I thought about they had to hand dig the water race.
Yeah.
And it took them 3 years to do it. It was 47K long. And I thought, it's a pretty special place, and if I could get other people to maybe come on board and help me, which I did, I got some woofers to come out and help every now and then. And so from then on in, for the next 2.5 years, it just carried on digging. So right through winter, right through summer, we didn't stop. So there'd be times where we'd have to sometimes take 30 or 40 centimetres of snow off before we hit terra firma, before we hit the ground, and then we'd start digging. So we'd have that, and then conversely, in the middle of summer, we'd have 30-plus degrees with no shelter.
So how many kilometres of tracks have you got to you now?
So the Welcome Rock Roaring Lion Trail, it's a 27-kilometre loop, and, 22 kilometres of it is all hand-built. Yeah.
Have you got accommodation on the station as well?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, right at the start and the finish of the loop is the Southland Ski Club hut. Okay, so that was built in 1936. It was a 1917 Dennis steam truck, took the materials up to where the ski hut is now. The steam truck ran out of steam, broke down, so they built the ski hut there. And at that stage, you were getting these hardy souls who would come up. They would make skis out of beech wood. They'd take a bag of porridge and a bag of coal, they'd trudge their way up, and four of them would stay in this hut. And then they would pop across onto the eastern side of the range, which was where all of the snow settled, and ski for the day. So that's sort of slowly but surely being restored. That's the start finish. But then we built a hut called the Slate Hut after the Slate Range, which is only a couple of hundred metres south of Welcome Rock, which is the highest point.
Is that the rock we can see right at the top there?
Yeah, the biggest cluster of rocks on the top there. So, yeah, and Welcome Rock, its namesake comes from, in 1886, a guy called Clement Davis recounted what he saw when he got up to the rock, and I've actually inscribed into the rock describing what he saw, and he said, oh, it was a hard journey, but my exertions were well rewarded, for when I got to the rock, even though there was a nasty vapour in the valley below, after a time it cleared, I could see the golden grains in the valley below, and I could see my old friends, the Takatimo Mountains in the distance, I could see the Eyre Mountains, I could see Mount Jane, Eyre Peak, I could see Mid Dome, East Dome, West Dome. So he was describing six distinct ranges that he could see. So, yeah, it's an incredible view from up there. But also another reason why it's welcoming is because when the early pioneers settled there, they would meet each other at this point. Those in the know, they could find a bottle of whiskey that was cached in the rock. So if you could find it, you were welcome to take it out, have a little dram, celebrate friendship, celebrate meeting together, water your horses at a spring at the back of it, and then carry on your way. So we've carried that tradition on. There's a bottle of whiskey actually hidden in the rock. So people who bike the trail or walk the trail or stay at the huts, they can actually search for it.
Now down in the valley, we can see a market garden.
Yep.
That's been established in a paddock just behind your house.
Yeah, that's correct. It's interesting, you know, when you're standing up here and you talk about scale, this place is 2,500 hectares, and then when you look down at Brendan's garden, you know, that's 1,200 square metres. And every time I come up here or I go to the top of the farm and I look back down and I see this 1,200 square metre little patch of dirt, you know, when you compare that, I think to myself how incredible it is that area of land can feed hundreds of people. It never ceases to amaze me.
My name's Brendan Lopez, originally from the States. I've been in New Zealand now for just about 4 years. Been on the farm here in Garston for three of them. And I run a market garden on this massive station, providing mainly for restaurants and retail in the Queenstown area, a bit in Southland, and doing one market in Queenstown on Saturdays.
So you started this from scratch?
Yep, it had all just stock rotation through it, so it was already really, really great, fertile soil. After initial soil tests, I was amazed at the organic matter and nutrition already in the soil. And yeah, thankfully, with being up here on the terrace, with glacial drift, all of the rock had drifted down towards town and towards the road, so breaking of this ground pulled up maybe two or three rocks total.
That's all. And this is an organic market garden?
Non-certified organic. We use all organic practices, organic fertilizers, organic compost tea, organic fish fertilizers, organic seaweed. I don't do any spraying of any organic sprays either. And when it comes to pests, my main management program is to keep things like the brassicas covered. So the main focus is prevention rather than intervention. And if it comes down to it, then I will intervene. Actually, just this afternoon, I released some dusky lacewings, which are a predatory insect, which will take care of, hopefully, the aphid issues I have at the moment.
What do you grow here?
Mainly doing a lot of salad mixes. Just a mesclun mix is the most popular. Do a lot of baby carrots for the restaurants as well. And this time of year, we've got a few different types of courgettes going, just kind of your classic yellow and green, and then a bit more specialty, the scallopini style, and also the kamokamo, the Maori squash. Do fennel, radishes, beans, just coming on to the point when our winter brassicas will go in, things that'll be cold hardy and keep going through the winter. Try to go year round, which is usually pretty good, usually just towards the end of the winter, kind of get a bit thin on things, but the weather is here is pretty forgiving in the winter. So yeah, if you grow the right crops, they'll do just fine.
And I guess you must spend heaps of time weeding.
Less and less every year, because I also use a no-till practice. I tilled the first year to form the beds and haven't tilled since. By not doing that, I'm not inverting the soil and bringing up weed seeds every year. So it's just, yeah, constantly staying on top of it, and then using a few other techniques. Like, I've got some beds covered with tarp and weed mat. So before some beds are going to be planted, I will prep the bed and then cover it with that weed mat and, you know, make sure it's nice and wet before it's covered. And that will force any weed seed to germinate. And then a week later, I can take the cover off and just give it a quick cultivation and plant straight into that. And that should take care of that run of weeds.
You've got broccoli plants under a cover in front of us. What are you protecting them against?
The white butterfly. Yep. Any brassica, they really go after. Broccoli, kale, cabbages, they just, this time of year, it gets so bad. And yeah, as I was saying earlier, aphids attack the brassicas as well, but a few other things. And yeah, we've been releasing predatory insects to hopefully take care of those. Ladybirds, lacewings, and predatory wasp called aphidius.
How satisfying, working with these insects.
Exactly, yeah. We're just working with nature to benefit us and the soil as well by, you know, not spraying, not tilling, and keeping the soil life happy.
What's your story, Brendan? How did you end up in Southland?
So I came to New Zealand in 2019 with my bicycle and had the goal of doing all the 23 great rides in New Zealand. So I had made my way down to the South Island and had been doing the Around the Mountains trail that comes straight through here. And yeah, on my adventures, I would stop every now and then and, you know, look for a place to woof or, you know, somewhere to stop and earn a few dollars, keep me going. And Tom and Katie had posted on the woofing website that they were looking for someone to process some firewood. So I figured, oh, this is right on the trail. I can stop for a couple weeks. And 2 days later, we were in lockdown. So it went from a couple weeks to a minimum of 6 weeks between, you know, level 4 and level 3. And yeah, we just got to know Tom and Katie and their family really well, and we all hit it off. And I have a background of market gardening in the States and did a bit of research over the time here. And there was definitely a gap, you know, especially spray-free, non-certified or certified organic options in the area. So decided to step in and fill that gap, and they were kind enough to give me this little bit of land. You know, not like they're short on land out here, but it's just great. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a beautiful spot to work and couldn't have asked for much more. You just never know how it's going to work out or where you're going to end up.
You're quite passionate about this, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's what I wanted to do, and it's great, you know, the people that I get to meet working with the chefs, and down the line I would also like to get into maybe a bit of workshopping or, you know, teaching people how it can be done.
Brendan Lopez there at Welcome Rock Gardens in northern Southland. Cosmo was also talking to Tom O'Brien, who built the Welcome Rock Trails in the hills above the Market Garden at Blackmore Station. And if you'd like to see some photos from the day, go to the Country Life webpage. There's heaps there.
Hi, I'm John Hellstrom. We live in Endeavour Inlet, which is one of the coolest parts of New Zealand. And every Saturday morning, one of the highlights is listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Sally, you were at the Central District's Field Days last week. Now, to be honest, I haven't been to a Field Days for years now. Are they still full of, you know, four-wheel drives and massive new tractors and so on?
Yes, but there's lots of other really sexy stuff like drones and things,
awesome.
Which really excite me because I love things that fly. When you head to big events like Field Days, there's so much happening, it's really hard to know where to begin. Now, this one is billed as the biggest regional Field Days in the country, and it brings the ag sector together from the big farming and growing regions of the Central and Lower North Island. I kept going past the delicious smells from food stalls and a tempting tipple of whiskey, being St. Patrick's Day, and a little bit of a theme developed as I chatted. It was more about, you know, new tech and a bit of number eight wire thinking and how people with these products were aiming to make life easier for our hard-pressed farmers and growers.
I'm Robert Mee. I am the head of GIS and engineering at Aerolab, and we're here today at Central District Field Days, and we've got our drones and robots on display. So we've got our P100 spray drone running. Small traditional hobby drones, or the barking drones that a lot of farmers are familiar with, have been around for a few years. This is kind of the next generation up. This drone here can carry 40 kgs of liquid or 60 litres of granules.
So it's used for spraying and spreading?
Spraying, spreading, yes. And it's set up to fly autonomously. So you can mark out your paddocks, or you can mark out your nursery, or your whatever you're growing. Click the button on your phone and off it goes. Anytime it needs a battery swap or it needs a recharge on the tank, if it comes back to you, lands, you top it up, press go again, off it goes again.
So how far can it spread?
Drones at this size now, what we're looking at here, can comfortably do a couple hundred hectares in one half a day.
Quite a big thing. It looks quite heavy.
Yeah, so it's actually not that heavy, but with the props folded out, you're looking at about 2.5 metres by 2.5 metres. So it's getting up there in terms of size, and it's a serious piece of kit. But in terms of the drone itself, everything you see right now without its carrying capacity is about 45 kgs. Fully loaded, with a tank full, the batteries fully in, when it takes off weight, it's just under 100 kilograms.
What are the disadvantages of the drone?
Yeah, so probably the main disadvantage right now is that compared to helicopters, it's still not as efficient if you're doing that large area spraying. But we're finding drones now are doing a really good part in terms of being able to cover the areas that helicopters miss. We have a much lower offset, so we can get in there and spray very, very accurately. So for any operations that are worried about spray drift or cross-contamination, drones is able to put product on much more precisely and much more accurately than helicopters would. We're also finding that a lot of the feedback we get is that customers aren't able to get helicopters in at certain times. And being able to have a drone on site on their farm and being able to just get that drone out whenever you need something done, press the button on your phone and off it goes doing, is invaluable to them.
So is it run off an app?
Yeah, so, well, it has a controller, like a normal drone, but the idea of these drones is that you have everything on an app, and what your app does is pretty much, for your property, you can set up all the boundaries for your paddocks, and that gets saved. So every time, for example, I want to go and spray out my paddock 5, I just load paddock 5 on my app, press go, drones knows exactly where it is, off it goes, does the spraying and spreading.
Can this be used for frost protection as well?
There has been talks, especially at vineyards, in terms of getting these drones. Our older drones are probably a bit too small for that, but definitely this P100 here is able to push down enough air that if you have multiple of them operating over a vineyard or over a growing operation, it can definitely protect, move enough air to protect the crops.
And the big question, how much does it cost?
Yeah, so Aerolab, we offer a full concierge service. So we not only sell you the drone, but we also provide you the service in terms of getting your certifications, doing all the training, getting you set up in the field.
So you need certification to use it?
Yes, and in terms of pricing, you're looking at from about $40,000 to $100,000 for an operation.
Should we see it in action?
Yeah, let's do it.
How high does it normally have to go to get a good effective spray?
So normally with these drones, you're looking at 6 meters high. And that gives you a really, really nice spray swath and good coverage. But with these drones, you can pretty much tell it however high you want it to fly based on what you're doing with it.
So it's just literally going up and down automatically?
Yes. So I'm flying fully autonomous. So this route for this paddock here has already been uploaded to the drone. So the drone knows exactly where to go and how to fly itself. And so right now you can see that the drone has emptied its tank. So it will automatically land. And now we can go and top up the container with liquid. And then after that, we can just press resume and then it carries on where it left off. The great thing about these drones is that once you set it up once, everything is just fully autonomous from there on. So we have farmers that have gone and mapped their entire farms out, marked out where all their paddocks are. So every day when they need to go spray or spread something on their paddocks, they just press go on their phone and off they go.
So I'm Chris Clifford, Managing Director of Agri Automation New Zealand. So what you see here today is the GoTrack autonomous auto drive. So it's a self-drive tractor system. So it's retrofitted and it enables you to take the operator out of the tractor entirely.
It drives itself?
It drives itself.
So what is the need for a driverless tractor?
The biggest need in New Zealand is labour scarcity, the scarcity of qualified, competent operators. It's a huge problem in all areas of agriculture, particularly the high-intensity jobs like vineyards, orchards, tree and vine crops, where you know, you're driving repetitive, boring work, mowing, spraying, and these sort of tasks that you're driving up and down the same rows day after day after day, doing long hours. That's mentally fatiguing on the operators, so it could lead to health and safety issues. What this system allows you to do is take that operator that's skilled and use them to then become a fleet manager, maybe managing 2, 3, 4 machines, so quadrupling the amount of output from one person and using their skill sets to set up the jobs, manage the machine, and they can do that from the comfort and safety of an office or a vehicle rather than sitting in the cab day in, day out.
I understand that this system was invented in Europe by a couple of orchardists.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it comes out of Poland, so some really clever guys who had these same challenges on their own orchard, and they were looking for ways to automate boring, repetitive tasks and run them autonomously in safety. So this system has been working on their orchards for more than 4 years already, so in real-life conditions.
And the tractor, the vehicle that you need, what sort of spec does that have to be able to fit this system?
We can fit it to an old Massey Ferguson through to the very latest and greatest, the Fendt John Deere systems. So.
Even a big old, chunky old vehicle like that, one of those old things?
Not too sure if we can do it on a traction engine, but we'd have a good shot.
Hi, I'm Sally from Country Life. don't mind sitting amongst all this noise, you guys.
What
all
noise?
This putting and spluttering and...
We like it.
That's good noise. That's what it used to be like 50, 80, 100 years ago. Everybody worked with it. And everybody might have been half deaf like we are now too, but that's beside the point.
Tell me about the machines.
Right. Well, that there's a Lister R, 8 horsepower, built around about 1926, used for driving wool shed in New Zealand, but in the UK where it was made for thrashing machines and exported around the world, pumping water as it's there. Yeah, so that's 98 years old, or 97.
See, the thing, these machines were made when power wasn't reticulated around New Zealand, electricity as such. So to milk your cows, pump your water, cut your firewood up, all those things, you needed some sort of a stationary engine, so that's what they used. And whatever ranges, sizes, you know, but mostly wool sheds and cow sheds. That was the popular thing. And so it wasn't until the 50s that power got reticulated, and then the farmers said, well, we don't want to play around with these, we just want to push a button and everything goes. And that's why these became obsolete. And that's the demise of them, yes. But we were brought up them as kids and clicked onto the hobby, and so we restore them for a hobby.
How much time do you spend restoring?
Don't ask. My wife would not approve. A lot of time. I've got about 48 engines, so all different shapes and sizes. And
Where do you get them from?
Oh, I've been collecting since I was 12 years old. I had my first one from the farm at Taihape, and from then on it just went on and on. And then I got married, and then I got another one and another one, and then the disease hit in. And so that's how it all evolved, really.
They don't cost much to run. You never tell anybody what it costs, otherwise you wouldn't do it.
What's that one running on over there?
Petrol. Mm-hmm. This one behind you is running on kerosene. Yeah, and that one's diesel.
Do you get a lot of people coming to have a look at these engines?
Yes, we do. Yes.
With a lot of the parts are open and moving, you can see it all happening. So they understand. So you can explain how an internal combustion engine works, rather than to say, you know, it's a box and an engine spinning and the flywheel spinning around. You can actually see what's happening. Yeah.
I can't help but notice that you three are sitting directly opposite the automated tractor over there and the drone that's doing the work.
That technology is beyond me.
These engines will be around in another 10 years. They won't. They'll be in the scrap heap somewhere.
Would I be in the role? You don't see a computer here, do you?
Have a seat. There you go. There's a good one for you to try it.
Wow, these are something else. I was attracted by your sign.
Okay, it was
Woodsy since 1999. Woodsy Rocker.
Yeah, Woodsy Rocker is the agricultural stress relief implement. So if you're feeling a bit agriculturally stressed, this is the implement for you. The whole principle is they're on a harrow tine off a scour harrow plough. And I've designed the chair around that, so it gives you a beautiful rocking action, smooth rocking action. I make all the parts myself. It's my own design I've been working on for probably 16, 17 years now.
Explain the concept. Well, or should we sit down as we
do
that?
Yeah, have a sit down and we'll be nice and comfortable. So the concept really is just using
I'll have to get you to hold the mic.
Okay then, sorry, that's all good.
Okay, I'm sitting down. Oh,
yep.
Oh, it's comfy.
Yes, very comfy. So it gives you a lovely rocking action. So, yeah, quite unique, very soothing. So, yeah, basically the concept is just to have a very nice, smooth rocking action. No moving parts as such. Yeah.
Woodsy, explain the design for people who can't actually see this.
Okay then, so you've got a stationary base. So the base with a little side table to put your cup of tea on or whatever. The tines are bolted to the base, and then the chair is bolted to the top of the tines. And they have a canvas with rope lace, so they do quite supportive and comforting. Contouring.
So what gives it, what's the mechanics that give it the rocking motion?
Well, it's really just frictionless. It's just the tine itself moving backwards and forwards as they do in the paddock, really, except it's upside down. Yeah.
And the tine, what shape is it? Is the tine?
Well, I call it an S tine, so it's like a shape of an S, yes. And there's two different, there's a 10 mil tine and a 12 mil tine for different firmer action or softer rocking action.
So what on earth gave you the idea to use farming implements and turn them into a rocker?
Well, I was actually, when I was living in Pennsylvania at the time, actually, and there's a lot of rocking chair makers over there, and I wanted to design my own chair, and I sort of came across these cultivating tines over there, and I just sort of based the design off that. Took me about 3 or 4 months to nut it all out and came up with this very simple sort of design and just gone from there.
And did you have some aches and pains yourself from being a farmer?
Well, I'm a shearer, so yeah.
You certainly would have a few aches and pains.
Yeah, so no, just, it was very good after a day shearing, sit back and, yeah.
Have your aches and pains all been relieved?
Oh, not really. Not because of the chair, but it's just they keep coming when you're, 59 years, yeah.
And who buys these?
Oh, everybody, really. The young ones, the young mums, they love them for their breastfeeding and stuff like that, because it's just a lovely, rocking, smooth action. And, yeah, anybody, really, older, not just older, retired people, they get a lot of comments. Oh, I'm usually it's the older 70, 80-year-olds say, oh, I'm not old enough for one of them yet. But
how many have you sold?
So I'm up to, I number each one, and I'm up to 458.
Well, it's been lovely to have a sit and rock in your chair and take the heavy weight off my feet.
Oh, there you go. Come back later on in the day when you're done.
Thanks, Woodsy.
Bring a beer back.
I've come to the Wairiri stand, and I'm with
Emma Pettigrew.
And what's your role with the stud?
Data and genetics manager.
So what have we got here?
So we've got some of our nudie ewe lambs, our purebred nudies. So they are part of a bit of a adventure with bringing in some hare-type sheep from the UK. So we bought in embryos and straws last year. We're going to do it again this year. And we've got these hare sheep that don't grow wool.
So they have a kind of a pelt instead of a woolly fleece.
Yes, yeah, that's the one. It's sort of, it's a bit fluffy, a bit woolly, a bit hairy, but it's only sort of half an inch to an inch long maximum. They are a sheep that is low maintenance. We haven't touched them with a handpiece. We haven't gone anywhere near them with any dip. They don't grow wool. You don't have to shear them. You don't have to dag them. You don't have to crutch them. You hopefully won't have to dock them. It's a work in progress. We want to get a bit more carcass, some facial eczema resilience into there.
So they're not as meaty as you'd like?
No, not yet, but they're still a meaty animal. They had a very similar carcass composition when we scanned for the eye muscle area, as what our Romneys do. And they are heavier than they look, but they are a sort of smaller, mature sheep. Sort of capping out at 60, 65 kilos.
And what's the interest been like from farmers here today?
Yeah, a lot of interest. There's definitely a lot of farmers that are quite keen to get rid of the dagging and the crutching and the handpiece work. And there's also been a lot of lifestylers quite interested as well, because it's quite hard to get a shearer out to a lifestyle block for 10 sheep.
But what about the beautiful wool?
Well, we're not giving up on wool at all. We've still got our Romneys. We would love to see it make a comeback, but we are hoping that if the nudies do take off a little bit, there will be a bit more of a balance in supply and demand.
That was Emma Pettigrew of Wairiri Stud. Now, you may remember we went to the stud last year as those nudies' mums were about to be inseminated, so it was really interesting for me to see their lambs at the show. Now, I was also speaking to Robert Mee of Aerolab, Chris Clifford of Agri Automation New Zealand, Andrew Donaldson and Bill Williams, who were there among the spluttering traction engines, and Vaughan Wood of Woodsy Rockers.
Well, that's it from nudies and drones. That's all we've got time for you this week. I hope you have a very fine weekend. Bye now.
Ka kite anō.